Welcome to the Dietitians Unplugged podcast with Erin Flores and Glennis Oyston. Join us as we explore the idea of health and wellness from a new perspective. Each episode will explore topics that will help you improve your health, body image, and fitness without obsessing over the scale or counting calories. We believe in health at every size, intuitive eating, and body positivity, and each new episode will help you build the confidence to ditch the scale and embrace your health without shaming your body. Hey guys, welcome to Dietitians Unplugged, the second episode. This is Erin and Glennis here to talk about a book by Tracy Mann called Secrets from the Eating Lab, The Science of Weight Loss, The Myth of Willpower, and Why You Should Never Diet Again. Hey Erin, how are you?
Very good. This was a really interesting read. I'm glad that we picked this book to sort of really look at the science of diets. I had a great time reading it, and I felt like it reinforced some of the stuff I already knew, but gave me so much more information that I had never even heard of.
Right. And I think one of the reasons we wanted to talk about it was that we really believe in not dieting and not having an intention to lose weight with your diet, because it doesn't work, and all the evidence shows that it doesn't work. And this book is so great about summing all of that stuff up. So I think that's kind of why we wanted to use this as a focal point for this podcast.
Absolutely. And it, you know, again, it sort of brings credence to a lot of the things we are promoting, but it uses research to back up a lot of these themes that are going to come up, in our practice and in our podcast.
Yeah, so much evidence in this book. Do you want to start talking about a little bit?
So, you know, the book is sort of laid out in three distinct sections. The first section really goes into looking at all the different research about why diets don't work. You know, she really goes back even, you know, 40, 50, 60 years and looking at research and why we say that 95% of diets fail, and looking at that sort of seminal work back in 1950 that gives us that number. You know, it's odd that we quote a research article from 1950, right? But when it still hasn't been refuted, it's still so important.
Right. I think that's one of the reasons that we quote that number so much, is that somebody actually sort of quantified it a long time ago, but unfortunately, or fortunately, or something, but nobody's been able to, like you said, refute it. So that, and all the evidence since then just keeps pointing towards that as sort of a fact.
Yeah. And the other thing I like that Dr. Mann does in her book is not only looking at the research that supports that diets don't work, but really looking at why weight loss research is flawed. The research, the studies that do show some benefit, why they're so flawed. And if we were to tease out a couple more things from those studies, we would inevitably find similar results and that people regain weight.
Right. Some of the information that was really interesting when I was reading was that through her research, she found that an average of 5 to 15 pounds is lost over the first 4 to 6 months of a diet, regardless of the kind of diet. So 5 to 15 pounds over 4 to 6 months. I mean, I know when I started dieting, I'm not sure I was looking at 5 or 15 pounds. I didn't have a number in mind, but I think if I'd just lost 5 pounds and spent a lot of money trying to lose weight, I would have been really unhappy. So I think that was the first kind of interesting fact, that not a lot of weight is lost and just within 6 months. And that is hundreds of studies since the 1940s. That has shown that, and that's regardless of the kind of diet. So we're talking either something like Weight Watchers or just healthy lifestyle changes, right, as people like to say.
The other thing that really stood out is, as we sort of looked at it, is what defines successful weight loss throughout all these years, and how, you know, we started at one number, like I think it was like 20%. You know, if you could lose 20%, that was successful, but then that number got changed, and then the final number that we sort of define as successful is 5%.
5%, which for a 200-pound person is only 10 pounds. And so if you're 200 pounds and, say, 5'5", you're overweight, and then you lose 10 pounds, well, you're still overweight. So, and I think that they chose that 5%, like you said, because nobody could sort of sustain more than that over a long period of time. And so researchers will call that successful weight loss. But through other studies that are sort of illustrated in the book, she found out that actually most people wouldn't be satisfied with that amount of weight loss. And in fact, people wanted a lot more weight loss, and that even when they reached a greater quantity than 5%, they were still unsatisfied with it.
Exactly. And I think, you know, it sort of points to, you know, what research will define as successful and what the person defines as success. And if the person doesn't feel successful, that they're going to keep at this routine until they feel successful. And so, you know, to me, that just highlights this cycle of dieting that, oh, I'm not quite where I want to be. And that when I get to that number, everything will be magically better. We know that it won't be, but in their head, I got to get to this number because that's when everything's better. And if I don't pass that finish line, I'm a failure.
Right. And the problem is that a lot of people don't even pass the finish line.
Exactly.
So
they give up before they even get to the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, the other thing that stood out to me is how well she sort of talks about this biology and psychology of why diets don't work.
Right. That was sort of the second part of the book about why diets don't work. So she spends a lot of time just showing the proof. Look, people just don't lose that much weight. And in the long run, they gain that weight back. And in the even longer run, they might gain even more weight back, so that you end up even fatter after a diet. But then she launches into the reasons why. So she talks about the biology of why we can't keep weight off. And that was really interesting to me, actually, that she talked about a set weight range and how that theory seems to be sort of really gelling, that people have this set range that they can maintain their weight within, maybe 20 or 30 pounds. But getting out of that range is you're just fighting so much. You're fighting the messages, the hormones in your body, the hormones that tell us when we're hungry and when we're full and that kind of thing.
Right. And you know, even looking at some of the studies where she talked about how these prisoners, they tried to get them to gain weight, and how, you know, they couldn't get them to gain weight out of their set weight range, no matter how much they started feeding these folks. So, you know, to me, that was really interesting because no one ever thinks about it from that end, right? Can we make someone gain as much weight as possible? And for these prisoners, they couldn't.
Right. I thought that was a really interesting study because I think everybody walks around thinking, well, it's so easy to gain weight. But actually, for a lot of people, you know, a lot of the thin people I know, if they really tried hard to gain weight, it's just not really going to stick for them.
And what's interesting is when I talk to those people, they're equally as frustrated. I can't gain weight. I really want to gain weight. I want to feel stronger. And they... It's interesting because it's the exact same comments that someone will say who can't lose weight.
Right. I have those friends too, or I've known those people over the years. Like, oh, I'm trying so hard to gain weight. They just can't eat more than what they can eat. Or even if they do eat an astounding amount of food, it's just not resulting in weight gain. The other thing that stuck out for me with the biology was that after a diet, your metabolism, or while you're on a diet, your metabolism kind of revs down because it perceives that it's getting less energy. And then your body becomes more efficient at fat storage. And that was kind of shocking, a little bit shocking to me. I not really thought about it in terms of that. So that a person who has dieted down to 150 pounds will not biologically be the same as a person who originally weighed 150 pounds without a diet. That the 150-pound dieter will have to eat much less to maintain that weight than a 150-pound person who's naturally that weight.
Right.
So,
and it, you know, again, we see it in practice, right? I mean, I've seen it with people that have, you know, been in a weight loss program and are saying, I'm eating so little and I'm still gaining weight. And at first people will say, no, you're just lying.
Right.
But in reality, that's what they're eating. And it's just because of their metabolism shifts, they need so few calories to maintain that lower weight. And the research here is just confirming that.
Right. And your body's become super talented at just saving your life and storing that extra energy, it gets as fat. So yeah. Because it perceives that you're basically in a famine.
Exactly.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And then she talked about the psychology. Do you want to talk about the cortisol?
So, I mean, you know, she goes into so much research about how cortisol is affected when we go on a diet, because cortisol is a stress hormone. And people who go on any sort of diet get stressed. And what happens is they're stressed, they're on this diet, and then their brain releases cortisol. There's cortisol floating around in the brain, but it also, that cortisol stimulates fat production. So, which then causes, makes it harder to lose weight, mm-hmm. maybe even gain some weight. That becomes more stressful. And then they're in this cycle of stressed out, you know, upset, angry, cycle that just leads to more distress, and there's no way out of it. You know, it sort of relates to this TED talk I just saw just recently about how cortisol in our brain, you know, causes us to have these sort of not very clear thinking when we're in the moment, right? When we get really stressed, mm-hmm. our thinking is not as rational as it probably could be as if we were not stressed. And this neuroscientist was talking about, instead of looking at a postmortem, you know, going back, what if we were to have premortems and look at, you know, almost plan for events as they come. And this really struck me as interesting because, you know, for food, for many of us, food is stressful. There's really no joy in it. It's just pure stress. And if we were to, with a very rational brain, when we're not stressed, come up with strategies that might help us think clearly about food, it might help us actually in the moment when we are feeling so stressed around food. But, you know, her talking about cortisol and how diets are inherently stressful just resonated with me as soon as I read that.
Right. And they did a study to show that. They actually had people dieting, and then people dieting and journaling, and then people just journaling. And they took the swabs of their saliva, and they tested the amount of cortisol in them, and that no matter what, if they were restricting, regardless of whether they were journaling or not, they had higher levels of stress. And so that's going to be a kind of chronic state of stress, which is terrible for us.
It's horrible. It's the worst.
Yeah. And then she talked a little bit about my favorite study, the Ansel Keys semi-starvation studies done back in the 1940s.
Right. I think anyone who's read intuitive eating, like, will hear about these studies and just like love them. I mean, it's so amazing all the information that was gathered.
Yeah. And what was amazing to me is that for them, semi-starvation was 1600 calories.
Right.
And so many diets now are much lower than that. I think I ate 1200 calories when I was really dieting.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's full starvation.
Yeah. And for the, I mean, just to sort of go back for people who don't know about this study, it was done in World War II mm-hmm. with conscientious objectors. And what they did is they wanted to see the effects of semi-starvation for prisoners of war. So they took these conscientious objectors, healthy males, and they first overfed them. I think they gave them like 3,000 calories, and then mm-hmm. they put them on a 1,600 calorie diet and basically monitored all their sort of both biology and psychology of what was going on during this calorie restricted period, but also once they were refeeding, once they were at a normal diet.
Right. And I loved some of the effects, the psychological effects of the diets, which is that they talked about food constantly.
Constantly.
They swapped recipes, or they talked about recipes with each other. They talked about foods that they were going to eat. And one person actually chopped two of his own fingers off.
Right.
I think that was the study, right?
Yes.
And he said, I'm not really willing to say it was because of that, but I'm also not willing to not say it wasn't.
And
that.
Even like when they revisit that, I think like in his, you know, 30, 40 years later, he's like, I still don't know if I did that by accident or if I was really so distressed that I chopped off my own finger.
Exactly.
But, you know, I always go back to that recipe part because mm-hmm. I think that's so interesting. I mean, we're looking at it from eyes in 2015. Mm-hmm. And for me to get a recipe, I need to walk 4 steps to my laptop, go on Pinterest and find something, right? There's no effort, right? Yeah. No effort. I turn on Food Network and there's a multitude of recipes. Mm-hmm. But like, think about 1940s men. how hard it must have been for them to start swapping recipes. I mean, like, they had to, like, probably go find a cookbook right. in the library or yeah. from their mom.
And I don't think that was an initial interest for them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, so to me, that just, I mean, that highlights such a food-seeking behavior.
Right.
So strong. Again, looking at it through a 1940s lens, that's an incredible drive.
And those really resonated with me because those were the exact same behaviors I exhibited when I was, you know, at my most restrictive point of my diet, where I became so intensely interested in food, much more than I had before, and recipes, finding recipes. I would just pore over, you know, the internet all day long. And so, and talk about food constantly, and that's what they would do. And that's, it just totally resonated with me.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that Ansel Keys study is just, you know, I'm so happy that she spent so much time in the book discussing it, because there are so many important parts of it that are true even to today.
Yeah, and I wish they would sort of try to replicate that, you know, and look at those psychological effects of dieting instead of just, what's the outcome? Did you lose weight? It's like, well, how was the quality of your life? Did you become weird about food?
Yeah.
So, and then the last part of the book, sort of talks about tips or strategies to improve your nutrition to sort of get to what she calls your leanest livable weight, which would sort of be the bottom end of your set weight range. And she doesn't call them, they're not diet tips, or she says they're not diet tips, but they are just strategies. Mm-hmm. And how did you feel about some of those?
You know, I've gone back and forth a lot. So, you know, again, I'm trying to look at it from two different lenses, one from a personal note and one from, you know, a dietitian and thinking about a wide range of clients I might work with. Personally, a lot of them seemed too diety for me. They would be a little bit too, not triggering, but they would make me feel like I'm on a diet.
Yeah.
But as I thought about it more, I thought about, you know, someone coming to see me who really was so confused by all the noise that we have around us about how to eat that's best, how to eat in a way that's healthiest for them. And I think through that lens, I think there's some pretty good tips in here that someone could use. And I think if you sort of come at it from that standpoint, I think that there's some really helpful things in here. And one of the things that I liked in there so much was talking about, you know, if you want to eat more of something, make it more visible in your house. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of hiding it or making, you know, putting it in the back of the refrigerator, put it out. You know, put it in front of the refrigerator. Put it out, you know, put a fruit bowl out on the counter. And I think that's something that seems like, oh, of course I should do that. But when she, you know, uses research to sort of say, no, if it's out there, people tend to eat it more. I think that's a really nice strategy. It's It's not diety, right? It's not, you know, restrictive. It's just saying, I want to eat more of this. How can I have it around me more?
Right. You're not tricking yourself.
You're not tricking yourself.
You're making it easier for yourself. Yeah. And her tips are all based on her research too. So it's not like she just kind of pulled them out of thin air. I agree that for someone, a diet survivor like me, a lot of these things, I kind of did them as ways to trick myself over the years.
Yeah.
When I was dieting. So for me, it's like you said, there's two different lenses. For the person who is recovering from dieting, maybe this is going to be a little bit, I think triggering maybe is the right word, actually. You know, it's going to be, it's going to feel again like a diet. But there are a lot of people who have never dieted and who want to just improve their nutrition. I think that these could work for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, as long as they don't become focused on a number. I think that's the real thing, is that when you're making changes, if you become focused on the weight, the number on the scale as the outcome, that is really going to mess with your eating and how you approach food.
And I think that's exactly why we come at it from an intuitive eating standpoint, right? Where it's like, there's not a focus on the scale. Health at Every Size is not a focus on the weight, rather behaviors. And this book, you know, again, she's not even claiming to be a part of intuitive eating or Health at Every Size. She's just saying these are benefits that might help people eat a little bit better for themselves.
Right. Yeah. And I liked some of the tips as well. her last tip was savor nearly everything, which I think is a great tip.
Absolutely.
So, and then she did mention intuitive eating a little bit. But I do appreciate that she's not originally a health at every size person. She's not necessarily in that camp. She said when she started the study, this research, she didn't really care which way it went. You know, mm-hmm. So I think that that is great that she's fairly unbiased that way, because I know people will sort of say that, well, if you're in that health at every size camp, that's the outcome you're looking for, yeah. to say that diets don't work. But she was not there, and she's not an intuitive eating person either necessarily. So I appreciate that, and that she's that the work seems very unbiased.
Absolutely. I mean, listen, if Tracy Mann were to call me tomorrow and say, I want you to come see my eating lab, I would go in a heartbeat.
Absolutely. I
mean, it seems like she has... really quite an expertise and team around her to help come up with thinking about a question, right? Really scientific, right? Mm-hmm. Thinking about a question, how are we going to get to the bottom of it, and how can we test it?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is such a skill that I just don't quite have, and I so admire.
Right.
So, you know, the fact that she was able to compile all this stuff into a book that's very easy for anyone to read, whether you're into science or not, I think is truly admirable.
Mm-hmm. And then she sort of wraps it up with talking about really focusing on the number on the scale is not going to do you any good. She does talk a little bit, I think, about the stigma around weight and how that's so problematic. And I appreciated that she sort of said in the end, don't make it about weight.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that's such an important part of today's society that doesn't go, that is not discussed enough. People aren't quite willing to sort of admit about the stigma of being overweight. And the fact that she brings it up here is really important to help people say, you got to be comfortable with your body no matter what.
Yeah. She really goes into the negative health effects of that
exactly.
kind of stigma. And yeah, so I really appreciated the work that she's done here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, again, I would recommend this book to people. I think it's definitely worth your time. It's not very long. I mean, I think, I don't know how many, but I think there's probably like 50 pages of annotations.
Right. So it's not nearly as long as it looks, actually.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah. And if you're contemplating going on a diet, you know, January is coming.
Yes.
If you're contemplating going on a diet, trying to lose weight, I would suggest before you do that, do the research, get this book. It's really a fun read, actually.
Yeah.
It's not, although there's a ton of science in there, it's not really, it's not dry. It's
no.
really readable. So, and then you're going to be fully armed about what to expect with your diet, with your weight loss plan.
Right. So we mentioned it early, but this is your premortem. Right?
Right.
So instead, you know, because you know your diet's going to be stressful.
Mm-hmm.
Here's your rational decision before you go on the diet. So do your premortem, read this book, and hopefully it will convince you to not January 2nd to not enroll in some crazy diet scheme.
Right, right. So that's kind of it for today.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back again soon.
Yeah, we have some other ideas coming up, and so we look forward to sharing more ideas about intuitive eating, health at every size. Again, this is Glennis Oyston and Erin Flores, and we are Dietitians Unplugged.